Welcome back to all our listeners here at the 9-8 Podcast, the home of progressive and underground music here and everything progressive and underground in Australia. My name is David Ellis, and as always, joining me from the west coast of this strange country continent is Mr. Alex Hogg. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well. How are you?
I am doing fantastically, aside from, you know, a couple of little blips on the radar, as it is at the moment. Media landscape, everything's always freelancing, so I'm at the end of my contract, so I'm out looking for some other work now, which is just a massive time suck. I mean, especially here in Australia. I don't know what it's like in other countries, but here it's a pain in the ass.
Oh, yeah. If anyone has any work in the music sphere, email Dave.
Yes, please let me know. the last week we had quite a spike, to be expected, I suppose, from our interview with Jordan Rudess. And I am really lucky that I get to see him tonight. I'm actually recording this 2 hours before the meetup here in Sydney that we are going to go on. We're going to hang out before the actual Jordan Rudess show here in Sydney at the Key Bar. And I'll bring you a little update on that later on in the series. I'll have a little bit to say about that. Hoggy, you had some because you actually saw Rudess the other night, didn't you? So
yep.
You had some little bit of a follow-up.
Yes, I flew over to Melbourne. Unlike certain other people in this podcast, I had to pay for my meet and greet experience with Jordan Rudess. Not mentioning any names, of course.
Listen, we've had this discussion. I need a win every now and then, okay?
Yes, I know. Anyway, so I flew over to Melbourne, caught up and went to the meet and greet with Jordan Rudess. Had an opportunity to ask him a couple of questions. The first among which, is a popular bugbear of mine, given that I live in the Android sphere, was why he doesn't do his apps for Android. Now, I'd heard him answer this question before on YouTube, and the answer that he gave then was too many pirates. Now, when I relayed this to Jordan, he sort of looked at me quizzically and said, "What, James LeBrie?" But it turns out it's actually a latency problem. The Android devices don't have the same latency that the iOS devices do, and therefore the programmers that he works with don't like developing for Android. Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, well, this is always one of the big things with Android so far as audio passing. I remember in the early days, there was something about couldn't pass out audio through the bottom jack and so on and so forth, whereas the Apple devices could. It just seems to be a latency issue with the apps and so on and so forth, and something to do with the software because there's not just one really. There is one standard stock version of Android, which is just standard Android, but every manufacturer has sort of their own version of it.
Adrian Ballou talk about this earlier with his app called Flux, which is a whole other crazy banana pants thing. And again, he only developing for iOS. Somebody asked him why he don't develop for Android, and he said that he'd have to develop something like 14 different working versions of the app, little changes for each of the different manufacturers. So
That's right. Yep. And then not to mention all the different screen sizes and everything. I mean, okay, so Apple has a few different screen sizes now, but they're mostly just the same thing stretched or compressed. So,
yeah,
you know,
and they also solve that problem by rendering their phones obsolete every 5 years and you got to move to the bigger one.
That's right. Yeah. What do you mean 5 years? Every like 18 months, buddy.
If the old ones still work for a while, anyway.
Yeah, they just stop. working.
Anyway, if you want Apple tech podcasts, go somewhere else.
Hey guys, this is Austin. Sorry.
No.
There'll be like three people listening that'll actually get that. So hello to you, fellow nerds.
Talking about is this the talk show? Is that John Gruber?
No, there's a guy on YouTube, and I don't know what his YouTube channel is, but he's a guy called Austin, and he does tech reviews. And that's literally the opening to every video is, hey, guys, this is Austin. And it's just, you know, like we didn't know that by watching the video, but, you know.
Anyway, so somebody else as well in the meet and greet asked him about his, like, biggest Spinal Tap moment. And he relayed a story about being in Mexico City, and everyone who's seen Dream Theater Live, which I assume is pretty much everybody listening, talked about he has his keyboard rig with a keyboard that spins around and tilts and does all sorts of fun things. So he was playing a solo or something, and he tilted the keyboard to the audience so everyone could see, and yeah, rock and roll. And then when he finished the thing, he went to sort of push the button to tilt it back again, and it didn't go. So he ended up playing the whole show stuck at a 45-degree angle doing all the keyboard parts and had to get his roadie to sort of help straighten him back out again at the end of the show.
I think he had a similar problem in Sydney when they played here the first time, the second time, his keytar didn't work. Could have been the second time, actually, from memory. You could see him reaching over and trying to do a keytar bit, and it didn't work. But, yeah, definitely the road is always fraught with Spinal Tap moments. And I think that was one of the things that really made that movie so popular was the fact that everyone who's seen it, who is a musician and who has toured at some point, have just gone, oh, my God, this is so true.
Yeah, I forget who it was. I think it might have been Tony Iommi. When he watched the movie, he said, this isn't a comedy. This is a like a horror movie, because it just sort of like flashbacks from all the tours he'd been on and
that's
stuff
right.
that's happened and all that sort of thing. I think it was him. It may have been somebody else that I'm attributing that quote to. But there was a lot of musicians who were like, yep, that's happened to me before.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very – it is very funny for that reason. And you've got a note in here as well in the documents. I should explain that, actually, because I say it a lot. You have a note in here. Hoggy and I have a document where we write down sort of a rough order and rough things we're going to talk about, and then we just sort of go hell for leather. So he's occasionally we've got notes that we're sort of looking at on a screen here. And you've got a note here that says he admitted the astonishing to be polarizing.
Like, that should be a surprise to anybody, frankly.
I mean,
the Astonishing album was a polarizing record, and a couple of theories on that. I think the album itself sort of went against the grain. Everything was sort of, you know, everything's a lot shorter and, you know, just sort of discrete songs and that sort of thing. And Dream Theater decided, you know, sod the lot of years, we're going to do a full Hell for Leather 2-hour long concept record that plays like an album, like a movie. I don't think a lot of people – well, I think it was a lot for people to get their heads around. The one question that I didn't actually get a chance to ask him – maybe you could do this one for me, Dave – is when the hell we're going to see a live DVD of The Astonishing. I suspect never, because I think this album lends itself to seeing live.
Yep, and that's everything that I have heard and read when I've spoken to people about seeing The Astonishing – live, is that they've all gone, it makes so much more sense now, because I visualize the whole stage show, you know, whereas having just heard the album and seeing a couple of the songs live, as we have here in Australia, I don't think we're ever going to get that full impact of it. Now, unless they have actually recorded the entire thing, which I doubt.
You think so? I thought they would have. Well, they would have recorded it, because it just the way I sort of now that I've had a chance to listen to the album again a few years after the fact, the way I sort of feel about The Astonishing now is how I feel about Marillion's Brave, in that you need to see it live to be able to understand the whole thing. And so,
look,
not seeing that is going to probably maybe limit, but it's kind of a catch 22 thing, because they put the album out, half the fan base loved it, half the fan base hated it. Maybe the tour didn't do so well potentially because they were playing the whole thing all the way through, And so maybe they're thinking, well, nobody particularly, well, few people like this album, few people are interested in seeing this album live, why bother putting out a live DVD if we're just going to lose money on it?
Look, potentially could. I mean, I would love to see it because I would actually like to see the whole thing in one go, and done from start to finish with all the stage antics and the in-between bits and the story bits and all that. But I don't know. I'm pessimistic on it, to be really honest, but I can always ask him. More than happy to ask.
I'd love to hear it straight from the source. I didn't get a chance to ask him myself, but maybe you could ask him and see what he says.
Yeah.
I'd be very interested to hear hear that.
I will note that down. But I mean, it might sort of depend whether or not they're in a legal battle with the New York Times.
I don't think
you saw this this morning, right?
I did see this morning. For those of you who haven't, the New York Times magazine put out their magazine cover, and it looks suspiciously similar to the new Dream Theater album, which, of course, have kicked off a whole conversation about who ripped off who. Both parties are claiming that it happened independently of each other, and I happen to believe them. What do you think, Dave?
I read the article, and from memory, there was a tweet in there from some person who was like, "I've never seen the album cover," which is not hard to believe because it is. I mean, Dream Theater are, despite being quite a large section of a niche, they're still sort of in a niche, that prog rock genre.
Yeah, it's so not exactly like the ripping off a U2 cover.
Yeah, exactly, or a Metallica cover or something like that. So, you know, it's not hard to believe that these people potentially didn't see it, but their explanation that they gave was that it was a combination between computer-generated images and it wasn't actually computer-generated images as in CGI, but as in someone took a photo and put it into a program and then a computer selected the things that should go into that. That's the way I read it anyway. I mean, I could have completely misread that. I don't like that explanation. It just seems, especially considering you can jump on any, what's it called? Any stock image site and find those images and drop them into something. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago when A Dramatic Turn of Events came out, there was a whole hullabaloo about Dream Theater using stock images. And I think from memory, Petrucci
like
came out. Yeah, I think from memory, Petrucci came out and said, of course it's stock images. We've been using stock images for ages. Like, this is not a new phenomenon. What's the problem? You know? But now because of the access of the internet and everything, people are finding out a lot of this information a lot quicker. That being said, the other flip side of it, I look at it is I go, well, the New York Times are obviously from New York. This album cover was released when? Like a month ago or 3 weeks ago or something. And suddenly these guys have something that is remarkably similar. I don't know.
Your point about the computer-related imagery is interesting, that the fact that the computer went in and sort of selected images, it wouldn't surprise me if the computer was drawing from some sort of stock imagery repository. And it's becoming easier and cheaper, at least as far as I can work out, to access sort of stock imagery depositories. So it's not no surprise, really, that more people are looking into it and saying, hey, they've got their images from here, because it's much cheaper and easier to access that. I assume, probably before the internet, stock images, you'd have to, go to a place and leaf through giant binders full of stuff, whereas now you can just access it from your bedroom.
That's right, yeah. The actual article itself says A behind the cover video seen below claims that the cover was designed by a combination of computer generation and photography. The magazine's design director, Gail Birchler, tweeted her response to the image stating, "Yes, these things look remarkably similar, but we have never seen the album. As far as I can tell, the album and our cover were released within days of each other. Sometimes people independently come up with the same idea at the same time," which goes back to what we were talking about Dennis the Menace the other day.
Yes, I was just about to say exactly the same thing. It's like on the same day,
yeah.
One in America, one in the UK, a comic called Dennis the Menace came out, and they were developed completely independently of each other. So coincidences are possible.
Exactly. But I mean, that being said, that was back then, this is now. As Phil Collins would say, that was then, this is now. I don't know. It's such a coincidence. You know what I mean? Like, it's literally the same thing flipped around. It's the same image flipped around. And I don't know. I just, it's a little bit suspect in my opinion.
Yeah. Whereas I'm taking the opinion that I think it's just a pure coincidence that's turned into a bit of a beat up. Which will be discussed and pontificated over by people like us for a while, for a few days.
Yeah, but I mean, the other thing as well is there's that old saying, you know, don't read your press, weigh it. If this gets this whole thing out there more, because undoubtedly people who follow the New York Times and such are going to then discover Dream Theater and so on and so forth.
That's a bit of a stretch.
I don't know. Yes, I find it a little suspect, but I mean, it is entirely possible. You never know. So
exactly. You mentioned Phil Collins a couple of seconds ago there. Phil Collins has
Am I going to hate you again? Is this another round where I'm just going to be like, you know what, Hoggy? You can go and fuck yourself, all right?
Well, he's announced a few more Australian tour dates. He's got a few more shows planned here in Australia now, which is kind of surprising because as far as I can work out, the first round haven't sold out yet. So I don't know why he's announcing a second round.
But, probably sold. I think it's sold out in Sydney.
Is it? Well, it's definitely not sold out here in Perth, that's for sure.
No, but we're not going into that again. It's perfect.
Yeah, we've already covered the reasons why the ticket prices are too bloody expensive and all the cheap seats are sold.
Exactly.
But he's also announced another round of European tour dates. So he's going to be playing through June in Europe, and he also happens to be playing in Prague the day before I've already bought tickets to a Mark Knopfler concert.
I refer you to my previous comment.
Well, it gets worse because King Crimson have also announced tour dates in the summer, and they're going to be playing three dates at the Royal Albert Hall. Robert Fripp has been rather open and honest about how much these ongoing Brexit negotiations have completely scuppered his planned 50th anniversary tour. Because the British government don't even know what's going on, so how the hell's he supposed to plan a tour? You've got, what is it, 8 members of the band. 4 of them are British, 4 of them are Americans. They would potentially have to sort out visas for all 8 members of the band for every single country that want a tour. Their tours are already sort of on the margins economically, so they've decided that they're just not going to bother. So thank you, Brexiteers, you horrible, miserable bastards. You've now fucked it for everybody.
Of course they have.
Yeah, because they don't give a shit about anything else but themselves.
No.
Or they believe Nigel Farage, and we're going to give £385 billion to the NHS. Oh, God damn it, that is not how any of this works.
One of my personal favourite things was seeing after that, and we're about to get on a Brexit bashing spree, was he had an interview, Nigel Farage had an interview on like the equivalent of the Today Show or whatever it was over there. Yeah. And he said, well, I mean, so that's £350 million a week. Are you going to now put that back into the NHS? Oh, well obviously, I mean, if I'd said that at the time, I don't mean that because it was just, obviously it was wrong. It's like, God, are you fucking serious? You had a giant bus driving around with it, you fucking tit.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
what
like
a
way to pass the buck, dickhead.
Oh, man.
Anyway, about Brexit some other time when they've actually decided what the fuck they're doing. But bottom line, it's going to be a lot harder for British bands to be touring Europe which means King Crimson are currently looking for other places to tour. Hint, hint. David, if you're listening.
Oh,
David Singleton, DGM president, you listening? Tour Australia. Come on. You know you want to. Do it. Do it.
It would be good. I would love to. I'd absolutely fucking love to see them.
Absolutely.
I reckon they'd blow my mind. So
they would. They blew the top of my head off the first time I saw them in Poland. So
fuck yeah, that's what you want.
The general plan is that I will be attending all three of these shows in London, subject to whether or not I can actually get a damn ticket. So yeah, I know, you hate me. Let's move on. The Phil Collins thing is less so. I don't know. I've already seen Phil Collins once. Probably don't need to see him again. So I might give that one. Might give that one a miss.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fair. But I mean, it is in Prague.
It is in Prague. It's at the O2 Arena in Prague.
You know, Prague's awesome. I love Prague.
It is. It's a fantastic town. I'd love to go back again. Well, we are going back actually because we're going to see Mark Knopfler there.
Yes. Well, exactly. So you can hear him sing all those songs like Sultans of Swing.
Is this another? Are you not a fan of Mark Knopfler?
No, I actually really like Mark Knopfler. He just can't sing for shit.
I don't think he ever said he was going to sing. Most of the time he's just sort of, it's almost like a talking thing. Especially like Romeo and Juliet. He's not really singing it per se.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I don't think he ever really claimed to sing.
Yeah, right. Okay, fair enough.
It's a definite style where he's sort of just almost like a talking thing.
So, maybe it is. Who knows?
Yeah. He's got a new album out sometime next year.
Really? Did you listen to the last one?
Bits and pieces of it, yeah. I know.
There's a certain point where they need to hang up the guitar.
Yeah.
And I think for Mark Knopfler, that was about...
probably 6 years ago.
No.
Privateering was a nice album. I quite liked that one, which I think is the second or third one. He's done two more since then, I think.
On the subject of touring, though, we did get a response from Josh Batten.
Yes.
Who
I had a great I had a chance to catch up with Josh while I was in Melbourne. Hello.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Yes,
hi, Josh.
I did. I managed to catch up with him. He is obviously a bit closer to promoters and that sort of thing in Melbourne than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned to me that the chances of Neil Morse bringing his band to Australia and tour are virtually nil.
Mm. Yep.
The word was too much money for no guaranteed audience.
Yes, exactly. So. You know, and I believe there was a little bit of conversation that went on after that as well.
Yeah, we can't talk about that.
Which, you know, we can't really talk about the ins and outs of it, but the general gist of it, I suppose, was that our market here in Australia is very small.
Yep.
Which is really annoying because, and I'm sorry, I'm going to get on a semi-socialist rant here for a second. This is the exact argument of capitalism, is that it's a free market. You should be able to bring things in and all that sort of stuff. But when it suits them, oh, no, you don't have enough fucking, you know, there's not enough incentive for us to go there.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. It's not a charity. They have to make money and sort of turn a profit.
I know, I understand.
Can't turn a profit, they're not going
to
be
100%, I understand that, right? But who has to turn a profit?
Well, presumably the band.
Yeah, okay, cool. So when you tour the Rolling Stones... the promoters lose money.
Yeah, but that's because the Rolling Stones are the Rolling Stones. They're virtually a law unto themselves.
Yeah, I know, but it's still bullshit.
It is bullshit.
Like, I'd rather go and see Neil Morse than fucking Rolling Stones, even if Neil Morse is doing his, you know, God-bothering stuff.
God-bothering.
You know, like,
yeah.
I mean, I probably wouldn't step foot in, say, Hillsong or something to do that, because I'm fairly certain I'd start smouldering. But, you know, it's, you know, it's just a... oh, man, it just annoys me. We miss out on so many really good acts here because we are so far away from the rest of the world. But there's also the flip side of it.
So few of us, so far spread out.
Exactly. But the other flip side of it as well is there's bands here that don't get a lot of recognition overseas for kind of the same reasons. So the band that I mentioned last year, Polaris, have been doing really, really well overseas, mostly because they've spent half of the fucking year in the US.
Yeah.
And that's
cool. You look at other bands. I mean, the other band we've spoken about, Southern Empire, as well.
Yep.
They've just done. They're currently in the middle of a European tour.
Yep.
And they're blowing up over there. People really love their music, and the new album is you know, gotten some pretty rave reviews from over the places. And yet they are virtually unknown here in their own country.
Yeah.
It's infuriating. It's like, what the hell are we doing? Is this the way that the music scene works here? Is that you have to leave, get big in another country like Pliny or Caligula's horse, and then suddenly come home to a hero's welcome? It's like, God damn it.
Basically.
This, of course, is one of the reasons why I wanted to start this podcast, so we could at least try and start talking about some of these bands now and not
absolutely.
Have to wait until they become big overseas and then suddenly everybody wakes up to the fact that we have amazingly talented musicians here in this country.
Yeah, I know. But one of the other problem as well you've got is very much, well, in Sydney anyway, there's nowhere for them to play, which we've spoken about before.
Yeah, the New South Wales government's done a fantastic job of dodging that fucking issue, haven't they?
Oh, fuck me. You were right. I'm just going to put it out there. We were both right. I think we both said that they were just going to be like, you know what? Fucking more police is what we need. We need more police. And shock horror, look what came out a couple of days ago. Oh, with the subheading as well. Also, water is still wet. Like, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. More police, more guns, more sniffer dogs, more shrimps on the barbie.
Yeah.
Water's wet, night follows day, details 11. You know, it's like, damn it.
Exactly.
And they pushed off the lockout law vote until after the next election.
Oh, I knew that was going to happen anyway.
Oh, yeah, because then it becomes a pre-election promise.
Yeah.
For the Liberal Party, anyway. We're going to repeal the lockout laws. No, you fucking won't. Stop lying.
I know quite a few people in the Liberal Party through friends of mine that work in Parliament and also being involved quite actively for some time in politics when I was doing some journalism stuff. And I was sitting down with one of the local members the other day actually having a chat at Parliament House, believe it or not, here in New South Wales Parliament House.
You're worried about setting yourself on fire walking into a church, but you'll go to Parliament House and not catch on fire there.
Well, yeah, it's a den of debauchery. I'm fine.
Right, so, carry on.
Anyway, we're yakking away, and I said, insert person's name here. I'm going to call him Cliff. It's not his name. I'm just going to call him Cliff. Cliff, what's the deal with the lockout laws? And he said, oh, mate, it's not going to get anywhere until next year. And I said, but you guys have said that you're going to, oh, yeah, we know that, but that's not going to happen. So why not? Well, why do you think? There's going to be an election next year. It's like, he said, why don't you just do it now? Like, stave it off, you fucking idiot, you know? Mm. Oh, no. It works way better if it's, you know, closer to the date. It's like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, that's one option. It also works way better if they put it into it as a pre-election promise, suck a bunch of people into voting for them, and then don't do it.
Yeah, but they're not going to do that.
What, you don't think they'll do? You don't think they'll try and do suck the people in?
No. They won't get to not do it because they're going to get their asses kicked at the next election.
Well, that's the other thing. They'll put it up as a pre-election promise. Suggest that we're going to do it after the election. No. And then when they lose and Labor inevitable or whoever gets in, Labor put it through, then the LNP can just turn around and say, oh, look at them. They're trying. They don't care about people. They just want to watch the world burn. And they can look like a bunch of authoritarian fucksticks to all their mates and all the people that actually voted for them. And there we go.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. And once again, we've devolved into a political podcast. We should rename this Totally the Wrong Podcast.
I think the politics of this particular situation, until it resolves itself, are inevitable to be discussed because it just underpins all of the problems that we already discussed. Why won't more bands tour in you? Why won't more bands tour? Because Sydney is such a horrible place to try and play live with lots of restrictions and curfews and problems.
Yeah.
Why did the music festival go to Queensland? Because they weren't being charged $200,000 by the New South Wales police to front up and be arseholes.
Yeah, that's right.
So it underpins everything. So
now, interestingly, that set list I sent you the other night when I was at Stephen Wilson, it had on it The Sound of Music.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't get to play it because of curfews.
Oh, God damn it.
Now, you know what pisses me off? That's my favourite fucking Porcupine Tree song. And I would have killed to hear it.
Yeah, but they dropped it out because he had to cut something.
Because he had to cut something because of fucking lockout laws.
Oh, God damn it.
Right? And when you're paying $130 for a ticket or something, I'm sorry, lockout laws and curfews should not fucking apply.
Yeah, but then, of course, if they break the curfew, they get a big fine. presumably.
Oh, I understand that. I understand how it works. It doesn't change the fact that it shouldn't fucking apply. I mean, they shouldn't even be there anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, well. We are getting way off track here.
yeah, we were supposed to be talking about the Astonishing on this episode. How the hell did we end up over here?
Oh, funny that. So, one last piece of news. There were a couple of videos that were put up the other day, which was an interview in the studio with Dream Theater, where it was really just an interview. I think people were kind of hoping that it was going to shed some light on the album, maybe have a few snippets and new things and all that. It doesn't. It's just a standard, pretty well standard interview. But the thing that I did find interesting was something you've actually noted in the notes as well, and that was the writing process is similar to Train of Thought.
Yes.
But so- yes, if it's halfway to Train of Thought, I'll be very happy.
Well, the writing process in terms of that they all got into a room and jammed, like was jamming on stuff, mm-hmm. as opposed to how I assume other records are done where someone comes in with a thing and then it's all sort of worked out, you know, in everybody's own separate recording studios. Mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. time they all got into a room and recorded, and they, you know, several members of the band described how well that works, you know, when you're feeding off other people in the room. And you're working on an idea, and okay, now it moves it. Oh, we all, you know, you all sort of feel it goes in towards this section, and they think that that has improved the music. So we're very interested to see what they mean by that when the record comes out. The other thing that they mentioned as well, they described now that they are signed to Inside Out Music as opposed to being signed to Roadrunner, that they have a different working relationship than with other record labels. The head of Inside Out Music, Thomas Waber, I think his name is, has been a Dream Theater fan for donkey's years. He was in the front row of their Ronnie Scott show in London back in 1995.
Wow, okay.
So he's been around for a long time.
So he's a big fan.
He's a big fan, big fan. And so when they came to sign a new record deal with a new record label, Inside Out was a pretty obvious choice. And they described how sort of when Thomas comes down to listen to stuff from the record, the band have been, I don't know, maybe a little bit more receptive to his ideas, as opposed to, take it when they went to record Scenes from Memory, Mike Portnoy's famous line to the record label was, "Get out of our way, book the studio time and let us make our fucking record." No outside producers, no outside writers, no A&R people coming down to hear what's going to be a hit, in quote, you know, quote unquote, a hit. They're just going to write the thing and, okay, here's the record, now you work with it.
Yeah, exactly. So and I think that's a really good way to do it, you know. Yes. Myself, I mean, I'm writing an album at the moment as well. Self-promotion. And, you know, the last thing you want is people coming in and being like, oh, so show me what you've got. And, you know, oh, that sounds really cool, but you could do that. It's like, hey, just fuck off. Let me do my thing. Talk to me after.
Yeah. And if you've got comments, I suppose when you're Dream Theater, you can make those sorts of demands to a record, because at the end of the day, nobody knows the Dream Theater fan base better than Dream Theater themselves. They understand what the fans want to hear, maybe, and understand what sort of sounds that they find work for them, rather than what some A&R guy says, oh, this is the sound you should be using. You need to sound more like this. And they're going to piss off.
Yeah. That said, and I think that brings us really well into their last album, where I would probably argue that they kind of didn't know what the people wanted. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, because I'm sort of a big believer in the people in the band should be able to write what they want to write, rather than having to bow to pressures and so on and so forth. So maybe we should talk about The Astonishing. Which we've been promising to do for quite a few weeks.
Yeah, we've sort of danced around this topic for a while, and any of you who follow what Dave and I have been saying, and Simo as well, have been saying on the Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand, it should be a surprise to nobody that all three of us didn't particularly like The Astonishing when it first came out. Now, you wrote a review of this album some time ago.
I did.
And you suggested a one CD track list.
Yes, I did.
For the benefit of those who may or may not have heard or read your review at the time, we'll put a link in the show notes for you. What were the tracks on that one CD? list. What did you have on there?
Yeah, so the tracks that I actually suggested, so I should probably put a little caveat in here, in that the time when I actually wrote this, I was living in Berlin, and I actually didn't have my big can headphones with me. So I was actually listening to the album through a pair of in-ear monitors, which were fine, I guess, but listening to it with proper headphones, as in cans, actually makes things, it makes a world of difference. Yeah, so I didn't quite do, I mean, I did do a good track list for the actual album, but there were a couple of real standout tracks that in the review I actually said should have absolutely been on this set list. One of them was A New Beginning, Moment of Betrayal, and My Last Farewell. To quote this thing, and I'm quoting myself, which is weird, these are a true return to form within a non-conformed album, and the tracks with the most replay value on the entire album, but they go to highlight exactly what I've been saying. It takes nearly 20 tracks for the album to become awesome and to have tracks with some decent individual replay value. Sure, The Gift of Music is a great track too, but the song released by the band to being one of the best individual tracks off the album is very un-Dream Theater-like. Because traditionally they always release the crappiest song on the album as sort of like the single.
Right.
And then everything was way better than that. And you got to remember as well, this album went for 130 minutes, I think.
Yep. Two hours, 10 minutes and 34 individual songs.
Fucking long album.
It is a very long album.
It's 34 songs. From memory, there's four bleepy bloopy weird ones.
I think there's more than four.
You're right. There's five. There's five. I'm sorry.
All of which I still skip over, by the way.
Yeah. They don't seem to hold any kind of weight within the entire album at all.
Well, when I heard it, I thought, oh, they must be like chapter breaks or something where you have they're trying to set it up like a play, and so you have different like act one, act two, whatever. And I thought, oh, these things must be there to kind of act as sort of chapter breaks. They don't though. They're just sort of there in kind of odd places.
Yeah, exactly. Not really. So the track list that I had for the entire thing was The Gift of Music, 3 Days, Brother Can You Hear Me, A Tempting Offer, The X Aspect, Road to Revolution, Moment of Betrayal, Heaven's Cove, Losing Faith, Hymn of a Thousand Voices, Our New World, and Astonishing. The last one was kind of optional, because frankly, I think the Our New World was a better ending.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I was listening to it and I got to the Astonishing, I was expecting a kind of bigger, grander ending to the story, and there just wasn't one.
No, not at all. It seemed like they sort of wanted to do the same ending from Six Degrees with a gong.
Yeah.
And it kind of came across that way, but kind of didn't work that way.
Yeah. One track that I probably would add to that as well that you've put in, I really enjoyed When Your Time Has Come. I thought that was a really good one.
Yeah, it's a good song. For me, I probably wouldn't have put it in there, but I mean, it just goes to show. I mean, what did I select off that? 14 tracks?
Yeah.
Out of 34.
Do you know what I think the problem with the record is?
Sure.
I remember Rick Wakeman saying something similar about Tales from Topographic Oceans, the Yes record from 1975. He said that they had too much music for one vinyl disc, but not enough for two.
Mm.
So they ended up padding it out. Mm-hmm. I've got a sneaky feeling that something similar may have happened to this record as well. Too much for one CD, not enough for two. So they had to kind of add bits.
I think for me, it really seemed like they were trying to cram so much in, and it suffered from an identity crisis in the initial. And I want to say as well, these are opinions that I've had since the album came out. Okay, before listening to the album again. Okay, so I said, you know, it was a pretty weak opening, disjointed messages and motifs, this identity crisis that it sort of wanted to be a bit of scenes and a bit of Metropolis and a bit of images and a bit of train of thought, but nothing really gelled. And then there were some really, really cool motifs and ideas that they had for some of the songs that came through that started off with this really cool proggy things with organs and everything. You're like, yeah, this is really cool. And then it just went into Disney ballad. And you sort of go, why am I listening to Frozen? This is supposed to be a Dream Theater album. And the thing, the irony was a couple of probably about 6 months before this album came out, there was a video posted on YouTube of what's his face, Dream, of John Petrucci doing a Frozen tune with his daughter.
Yeah, I was going to say, the influence of Frozen on this album is not something that I think should be underestimated.
No.
He was definitely influenced. And I think the other influence as well, Game of Thrones.
Mm. Yep.
Now,
absolutely.
I must be the only person in the world who doesn't watch Game of Thrones.
I'm the same, man. I don't watch it. I hate it.
I haven't watched it. Haven't read any of the books. I heard someone describe this as like Lord of the Rings with more porn.
Yeah, basically.
Having not watched any of the shows, I can't comment on whether that comparison is accurate or not. But
it's about
it comes
right,
from someone
though.
That I kind of respect. So
yeah, it's about right. I had a friend of mine once, and I said to him, "Mate, what is your obsession with Game of Thrones? I just don't get it. I've seen the first two seasons, right? I gave it a good go. I said, I don't understand it." And he went, "It's real simple, Dave. Tits and ass." And at least he was honest.
And fight scenes. Don't forget the fight scenes.
Yeah.
Sort of suppose. Like a medieval soap opera almost in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, but the thing that annoys me is it's a genre called fantasy and the guy's bringing gritty realism into it.
Mm.
It's called fantasy for a reason, you fucking idiot. Of course the heroes are supposed to survive. They're not all supposed to be slaughtered and raped. Like, it's just weird. Anyway, we're getting off traffic again. Off topic again.
Anyway, Game of Thrones. And somewhere between Game of Thrones and a Disney soundtrack, I think, is the influences for this album. The other thing as well that probably doesn't, that for me anyway, being such a big Rush fan, this album is always going to sit next to 2112 and Clockwork Angels as the albums that this one was trying to be.
Yep. Agreed.
The key for those two, 2112 took up one side of a vinyl, Clockwork Angels was an entire CD.
Mm-hmm.
This one is bigger than both put together.
Correct.
So the reason why I brought up my comparison to Tales from Topographic Oceans, too much for one vinyl, not enough for two. I kind of feel the same way about this album. Too much for one CD, not enough for two.
Yep. The other thing as well is, and I don't know whether or not you remember this when it came out, but there was a whole Choose the Side thing.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And it was like Ravenskill versus the
Great Northern Empire, I think was the other
Great
one.
Great Northern Empire, was it? There we go. Great Northern Alliance?
Possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, the good guys versus the bad guys, basically. Let's be honest. I think they really messed up with that because as soon as I saw that, I went, oh, so this is going to be a double album. That's going to be interesting. I wonder if we're going to have CD1 is the story from one side and CD2 is the story from the other.
That would have been cool.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think they missed a really big opportunity here to do something like that. You know, the same story, but from two different sides of the fence.
The problem is with that, though, wouldn't have that. I mean, it's all right if you could do that sort of thing. Wouldn't that potentially have made the storyline more muddled than it already is?
Frankly, I think it's muddled anyway. Because
well, that was the problem. That was the thing I was going to say is that by having only one vocalist try and do all of the characters.
Yep.
Yes, I understand why they need to do that because this is not an Arion record. You don't have 15 guest vocalists doing all the different parts of all the different albums.
Yep.
To have one person do all of the... I see what they were trying to do as well. They had like different musical styles for each of the characters that was attempting to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So you had real heavy stuff for Lord Nefarious and then you had sort of lighter, more, you know, acoustic stuff for Gabriel and stuff, and then a different style again for Faith and ludicrous names, by the way, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
I see what they were trying to do, but it just becomes really confusing towards the end. I'm like, hang on a minute, who's supposed to be speaking here?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the problems as well is if you go back to some of their earlier works, most notably, you know, Metropolis, for example, Metropolis Part 2, that worked with a single vocalist because it wasn't, I did this and then I tell you this and then that person then says, but what about me? And da, da, da. It does, it's not written like that. That was very much, you know, it was a third, it was from a third person.
Yeah. Don't know how you go about trying to tell this story from the third person. No, that would be kind of odd.
I don't know. Get someone to write it properly. Like, I know, and it sounds really harsh, but the reality is this was written by musos, right? And the album was written by musos. That's cool. It is not a musos album. It is an album that should be written by someone like J.K. Rowling or C.S. Lewis, although that would be very difficult for him to do.
He's dead. What I was going to say is this album sort of feels like the soundtrack to a movie that hasn't been made.
Yep, agreed.
I think if this album was better received, we probably would have ended up with the movie, but then you end up with another problem, is that if you're going to do a movie of this album, you better do it properly, because I don't know if you know this, but Marillion's Brave was turned into a movie.
Yes.
And it was done appallingly badly. So badly that when the band put out the re-released version of the album, they did EMI did a remastered edition, a special edition, as they're doing with all the EMI Marillion albums. And somebody asked on a forum, oh, why wasn't the film put in there? And the three-word answer was, because it's shit. It was terrible. Everybody hated it. The problem was is that EMI didn't really want to do a film. The band kind of said, well, we want the film, and I think it just got done really cheaply, very badly.
So all of that taken into consideration, right? It sounds like I hate this album. After re-listening to it, I actually don't mind it.
Yeah, I'd agree. It's not,
actually not bad.
It's not terrible.
It's not their worst album.
I'm going to say that Falling Into Infinity, I think, is their worst album.
Yeah, see, that's my favorite album, though.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say, I think it's their worst album, but because of what happened to it, because Kevin Shirley got involved, because they got outside writers involved in that god-awful You or You Not Me song. God damn it, that is awful. But that's the problem with it, is because everybody, all these other people got involved and tried to make it into something that it wasn't.
Yeah.
The problem I have with that record. And then there's When Dreaming Day Unite, but that was just like young kids writing a record. They didn't sort of really know what they were doing yet. And
exactly.
They've openly acknowledged that. They're like, yeah, well, we got some of the, like the orchestration of the stuff wasn't right. And it was all three of us trying to play in one register and it didn't really work. And Terry Date didn't really have enough time to make the record, like to produce it and engineer it properly. And they mastered the vocals to make Charlie Domenici sound like he was 2 feet tall and all that sort of stuff. There was a whole bunch of problems with that record.
I don't know. It seemed like The Astonishing was either too ambitious for the guys, which I know that sounds really bad because I'm a massive Dream Theater fan and I shouldn't be saying anything about something being too ambitious for Dream Theater, but generally sounds like they bit off more than they could chew. Either that or it was just a general fucking mess. There was, you know, a murky storyline that was hard to figure it out, which I think was basically due to the single singer. It's really interesting. If you look on YouTube, you can see a whole bunch of people that have done songs off this album with multiple singers.
Yes. I have seen a few of those. And it works
really well.
Yeah.
Like, I'm watching this going, this is amazing.
It'd be fun to do, actually, to get and almost turn it into the Broadway musical it kind of wants to be.
Yeah.
And get a bunch of people in to do the singing and have different staging and all that sort of thing. It'd be kind of fun to do, but
I think it would actually work really well.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the biggest problems is here in Australia, we didn't get to see the live show.
Exactly.
And from everything I've read, as I said earlier, from everything that I have read in this, about The Astonishing and the live show that accompanied it, people walked away from that going, holy shit, that album is incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and the problem is we didn't get to do it here. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like you've got a 10,000-piece puzzle and you've got 9,900 pieces.
Yeah.
You know, but the pieces that you're actually missing are the faces.
Yep. And whatever backdrop things went on with it as well, because I'm assuming they would have had video stuff. They would have had, like, little pieces playing in between.
Yep.
They must have done.
Well, I'd hope so.
If at some later stage in their career, who knows when that might be, they bring it out again and try and tour it a bit further. Well, or is this one just going to get sort of quietly pushed under the carpet and forgotten about?
I think it's probably just going to be taken out in the paddock, man.
Yeah.
Taken out to the long yard. You yep. know what I mean? Like, genuinely, I don't think it's, you know, really worth salvaging, which is really unfortunate.
This is why I want to know if there is ever going to be a live DVD. Are they ever going to put one out?
Yeah, well, I mean, it would be great.
Or even if there's like some sort of, maybe there's a bootleg version kicking around somewhere. Now, we wouldn't like to advertise where one could find such things, but I wonder if one does exist.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd love to see it. And this is really, this is one of the things I think that's really sad. Since Portnoy left the band, the whole focus on bootlegs and everything like that has really dropped off.
Yeah.
Because they were once upon a time a band that really celebrated their bootleg copies.
Well, some members of the band celebrated the bootleg culture. Let's be clear about this. There were one or two at least two members of the band who were definitely not pro-bootleg.
Yeah, and I reckon I know which ones they are.
Go on, guess.
I'm going to say LaBrie and Petrucci.
Yep.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Which is really sad because the reality is that's how they got famous. Sure, they got lucky with one song on radio and all that sort of stuff. But the bootleg culture was really what helped them out. And I think Portnoy recognized that.
Well, he knew that that's how that's how Metallica got started. That was tapping into the sort of bootleg culture and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These days, though, the bootleg culture doesn't really work because the bootleg, I mean, tape trading and stuff was all based upon you trade for me, you give to me and I give to you.
Yeah.
Nowadays with torrenting and stuff, that doesn't happen. Someone gets a thing, puts it out there, and then hundreds of thousands of people get it for nothing.
Yeah, but music piracy is almost dead anyway, thanks to Spotify.
This is true. I was having a conversation with my brother recently, and he was saying that basically nobody torrents TV shows anymore because Netflix.
Yeah. Unless it's not available on Netflix.
Yeah. Well, this is why, going back to Game of Thrones again, this is why that got such a bad rap in the press and all this sort of people were like, oh, you know, we're the torrenting capital of the world or something. Which
yeah, we are.
No, that's bullshit. The Russians have got us covered by miles.
No, they
don't worry about that.
No, we are the biggest pirates.
And
in the
why
world.
Is that?
The reason is because
Rupert Murdoch is the reason why.
basically, yeah, because they're not. And we're digressing, but we are unable to receive a lot of the programs that we should be receiving in a timely manner. I remember when Castle was a thing. I don't know if you ever watched the TV show Castle.
Oh, a little bit, yeah.
It was one of my favorite TV shows. I used to watch it every week religiously. Like when I was in the US, I actually blocked out time. I traveled to New York one week just so I could watch it in New York.
Nice.
Because that's where it was based, right? Big fan. So, and I happen to know a couple of the cast members and all that sort of stuff who were big fans of my old electronic music projects that I used to do. So, love the show and all that sort of stuff. But what was really fucked up was the fact that I could have a friend download the show for me 25 minutes after it aired in the US and watch it maybe 3 or 4 hours later. That same episode took a month and a half to get here to Australia on our TV.
Yep, I was going to say I had the same problem with House, for example.
Yep.
And in fact, the first season of The Big Bang Theory, back in the day when The Big Bang Theory was actually something worth watching, ha-ha. I was
going to say, you actually watched that because
my history with The Big Bang Theory, the first season was pretty funny. The second season was eh. The third season was rubbish. After that, I stopped caring.
Right, so after the third season, you stopped drinking formaldehyde. Okay.
So the point of the exercise is I watched the entire first season before it even looked like it was going to show off on Australian television.
Yeah. But that's exactly it. So, and I think unfortunately in with this, particularly bringing it back to The Astonishing, we need to see that live show.
Yeah.
I don't think we're ever going to see it in Australia. I don't think we're probably ever going to see it again, because I think the band has recognised that it was
a flop.
Well, yeah, it was a flop. And I think this is an interesting question, and this is a question I think that I don't really want to know the answer to, but I think it's sort of a good time to ask it, and that is Dream Theater relevant anymore?
Ooh.
Like, has the prog world moved on?
That's a good question. Yeah. Is it going to end up like Yes? Okay, God, I hope it doesn't end up like Yes, because that would be just depressing and would make me cry.
Yeah.
But in that other bands are doing the same style of music that Yes did far better than Yes are currently doing it.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, and I know that my musical tastes have evolved, and I know that I'm into a lot more stuff now than I was when I first got into Dream Theater when I was 13, 15 years ago. Shit, that's frightening.
Don't think about it too closely.
I know. So are they – is this – and I'm hoping that this next album is going to be as good as it sounds. But for me, it sort of almost seemed like The Astonishing was the swan song.
God, I hope not.
You know, it sort of seemed like this was it. That's it, boys. Pack it up. It's all over. And when you've got other prog bands out there who are doing things, a lot in Australia as well, mind you, who are embracing a lot of the newer things, you know, Caligula's Horse, Carnival, even Cog, they're a little bit older, but, you know, and then you've got a lot of the stuff from the States as well, the more
Southern
modern
Empire
stuff
as well. I mean, if we're going to talk about new prog bands, Southern Empire, definitely.
Exactly. You know, any of the guys that you see at Progfest, which is coming up in, what, January or something like that.
Yep.
You know, Voyager. I mean, the guys from Voyager, they are, I mean, shit. You know, they're one of my favorite prog bands right at the moment.
Absolutely. The other thing I was going to say as well that probably didn't help with the, I mean, and we've spoken about this on the show before, the distribution of this record and getting the special editions out to people was haphazard, disjointed, and surprisingly poorly informed. We've discussed before about having to kind of pull strings within the Dream Theater sort of fan club administration fraternity to try and find out what the hell was going on. I think part of the problem as well is the people that didn't buy the special edition, which, to be frank, was pretty expensive. The people that didn't buy that, I think, also missed out on something. And I'm not going to begrudge anybody who's saying, oh, you know, you missed out because you didn't get it. But the special edition did add something again. There was a sort of a playbook, lyric sheet. There were different, there was, you know, you had the, I think everybody saw it, the big Nomac play model thing.
Yep, yep.
And he had all the different cards and stuff in there. So I think people missed out on that because they weren't able to maybe immerse themselves in the album as much as the band were kind of hoping they were going to.
Yeah, and I mean, the question, and this is sort of another question that can be sort of raised from that, that you just said, that information you just gave, is should the album music stand up on its own without having to have all that other stuff? And I think it should. And actually put the headphones on and listen to the album and go, okay, I understand what's happening here.
Without having all the extra stuff around it.
Yep. Yeah. And if you're leaning on those other things, then, you know, it's like people who say, oh, to fully understand Star Wars, for example, you need to read all of what was the extended universe that's now all canon. Thanks very much, Disney.
Your Star Wars analogy is lost on me. I haven't really followed Star Wars that closely, to be honest.
I'm sorry, what?
This is a whole other topic we could save for another day.
Maybe that's another episode for the 2116 podcast.
My attitudes toward movies. But I was going to say, well, the analogy I was going to make was Stephen Wilson. He's obviously done the big fancy box editions of all the records, and the one that I'm thinking of at the moment is Hand Cannot Erase, where yep. you bought the big box edition and there was all these other extra little things about the character's life and the story and all that sort of thing. Now, yep. that thing was priced way too much for me to possibly afford, and I didn't need any of it because you still understood the story
yep.
based upon just the music and the lyrics.
Yep.
You kind of get where they were going. You didn't necessarily need all... Okay, sure, it may have helped you immerse into the story more so, but you didn't need it to understand the story at all.
That's right. That's right. Unlike almost what you needed with this.
Yeah.
You know?
You kind of needed all of that to get what was going on.
Exactly. And it's not like there's a sci-fi movie called Primer. I don't know whether or not you've seen it. It's touted as the most accurate time travel movie ever seen.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Right. It's a head fuck. Right. But you can watch it the first time and go, huh. Okay. The second time you watch it, you pick up so much more. I'm on to about my ninth watch.
Oh, okay. Right? I found that with The Matrix.
Yeah.
The advice I got from The Matrix was watch it and then watch it again. And
yes.
then you'll get it.
Yep.
I was like, that's okay. Right. Fair enough. Yep. I understand that.
Yep. And after listening to this, and I've listened to The Astonishing probably 4 or 5 times now through, it's still not as grabby as some of those other things that I just mentioned.
Even on the second or third playthrough for me, I was sitting down with the lyrics and trying to work it out. And even with the Wikipedia plot summary, it was kind of like, oh, okay, now I sort of get what they're trying to talk about here.
Yeah, but even then, I mean, I don't know, some of the lyrics are really ham-fisted, which, to be honest with you, I mean, it's Dream Theater. The lyrics haven't always been the greatest.
Yeah.
But even some of the lyrics in there, I'm just like, fuck, really?
Yeah.
Like, really?
I kind of touched upon this a bit earlier, but some of the names of some of the characters, I'm like, you know, this is kind of an eye rolling, you know, mm-hmm. Lord Nefarious and Faith and all that sort of thing. It's like, oh God, really? This is kind of silly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing that's really annoying was the whole thing of, oh, the noise machines, which is the Nomax, you know, mm-hmm. and that's the only part of entertainment that's around. And so the whole big controversy is there's someone that can sing. And it's like, that's the best you could do.
Oh, and the singing brings Faith back to life again at the end of the... it's like, oh, God.
I know. Yeah. And it's just...
It's a bit naff.
I mean, and there's all this other stuff like, you know, Heaven's Cove, right? Apparently, that's an abandoned amphitheater.
Uh-huh.
You know how I understood that?
Because you read it on Wikipedia?
That's right, on Wikipedia. I thought Heaven's Cove, I pictured Heaven's Cove to be like a cove.
Yeah.
You know? Like a place where boats land, not a fucking amphitheater.
I'm thinking may have been something that was probably brought out during the live show, possibly, maybe, who knows?
Yeah, again, and this is exactly it. There's so much information we're missing. But the thing that pisses me off is if you go and listen to any Broadway show, right, you listen to Hamilton or The Book of Mormon.
I was wondering how long before Hamilton came up on this.
You know, and I haven't listened to Hamilton, right, but my girlfriend has and she says it's awesome. The Book of Mormon. What's the other one that everyone loves? The one about the witch.
The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, but it's not Wicked.
Ah, yes.
You know, any of that sort of stuff, Jersey Boys, etc., right? You don't really there's no reference in there as to what the actual story is about. It's literally the songs and you can kind of piece it together from what's going on, right? Yeah. With this, you can't.
Yeah.
You need the story there to then understand the rest of the album, which I know. I think that's just wrong. You know, and I mean, for the fact that this was, you know, really, I mean, I don't quite understand why Wikipedia says this, but it says that Astonishing is Dream Theater's second concept album.
Well, the first one was Scenes.
Octavarium?
Well, they're thinking of a concept. This is the problem with concept album. There's two kinds of concept albums, really. You've got the story-based ones like The Wall or Tommy or Operation Mindcrime. And then you've got the thematic ones like Dark Side of the Moon, Octavarium, Misplaced Childhood as well to a lesser extent. Those sorts of concept albums.
Okay, yeah, I understand where you're going with it.
Yeah.
I
think that's what whoever has edited that Wikipedia article has decided that that's what a concept album means, where in reality there's kind of like two different kinds of concept albums.
I got to admit, and there are some good things about the album. First and foremost, I think it's in the X aspect bagpipes.
Yep.
I fucking love bagpipes. I don't care what they're in. You could have a bagpipe session in the middle of, I don't know, a Justin Bieber song and I'd listen to it because I love bagpipes. 3 Days, I love the ending of 3 Days, that whole ragtime sort of swing section right at the end.
Yeah, that was really cool.
I really love that. And it's that sort of stuff. It's these little gems throughout the album that makes me go, yeah, you know what? It's not a bad album.
Yeah, like it's not terrible. I call that as well, When Your Time Has Come. It's just a straight sort of ballad, really.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I love The Gift of Music as a song. Mm. It's just a great song. And the Our New World as well. Particularly Our New World, the version that they did with What's-Her-Face from Howlstorm.
Lizzie Hale
from Howlstorm. That was awesome. That was really good. And I'd like to see more of that shit. Like, you know, I hate to say it, but LaBrie is just getting on and he's just not cutting it so far as voice is concerned.
He's obviously been handed an almost impossible job with this record, trying to voice 5 or 6 or 7 different characters or how many people are there in a story.
Yep, yep.
And he's kind of been handed and it's like, well, this is this style and that is this style. And I think he's done a really, really good job given what he's sort of been handed. It's also worth noting as well, and I think this is probably going to be reflected in the new record, this album was written entirely by John and Jordan.
Yeah.
As far as I can work out, Mike Mangini and John Myung had no hand in writing the music in this album. It was kind of like, here's the record, here's your parts, go.
Yeah, that's
right. And I think that shows up in the music as well. There are surprisingly limited sort of bass and drum kind of moments.
I mean, that was something I think... I can't remember who it was that actually, I think it might have been All Music that actually pointed that out as well. They were like, Mangini and Myung weren't as heavily featured in the album, which is fine. I mean, you do that.
It should be a great surprise to anybody that obviously at certain times, certain members of the band write more than others.
Yes.
I'll take Yes for example. Yeah. Tales from Tropographic Ocean was written almost exclusively by John Anderson and Steve Howe. You fast forward several years to Open Your Eyes, for example. That one was written almost exclusively by Chris Squire and Billy Sherwood.
Yes.
And John and Steve were a bit miffed that we haven't really had much of a chance to write anything on this record. But then they were like, oh, hang on a minute, because on that record we pretty much wrote everything.
Yeah,
so
that's
different.
Right.
Albums are kind of written more or less by other members of the band. You probably haven't noticed because you don't listen to Metallica, but the last Metallica record, Kirk Hammett wrote essentially nothing because his phone crashed, I think, 3 weeks before the sessions were going to start, and he had something like 300 and something odd riffs on that phone, which he lost the lot.
Wow, he had 300 riffs all beginning in E. I'll be damned. Hang on, how many 99% positions are there?
99% of Metallica's songs are all written in E-flat minor.
24. What is that, I wonder? That's going to be really interesting.
What's that?
Well, there's only 144 frets on a guitar, fret positions. So, I mean, that's just incredible that he's able to write that many songs on a guitar when it's just, you know, he had 300 riffs. Wow. I'm just being a facetious prick right at this point.
And all in one key.
Yeah, exactly. More or less. Oh, man, here's a new idea. Oh, what's your next idea? Like the gust. I'm sorry. You're
a horrible, horrible man, Dave.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was about to make the joke, you know, oh, yeah, he didn't write anything. Why did his wire break?
Anyway, Prog's number aside.
The other thing to sort of note as well is that there were a couple of additional musicians on this album as well. There was the Millennium Choir, Fred Martin and the Levite Camp for the gospel choir sections, the Piori Cantores, which is a boys' choir, the FILM Harmonic Orchestra from Prague, and Eric Reigler, who played the bagpipes on the aforementioned The X Aspect.
Can I be the first to say, thank fuck for that, actual choirs being used on a record instead of the fake keyboard choral sounds which have dominated the last couple of records.
Yes, agreed. I mean, that being said, the choirs that were on Black Clouds and Silver Linings.
That was a keyboard choir.
Yeah, I know, but they were actually really good. They were actually fucking phenomenal. I've got the deluxe edition of that with all of the stem tracks and everything like that in it, right? And you isolate the keyboard sounds and they sound phenomenal. They sound really, really, really cool. But if you go a little bit further and have a look at all the production on this album as well, I mean, I count five engineers, two, three mixers. I mean, that's a little bit too much.
Depends what they were engineering, though. One guy does the engineering for the vocals, one guy does the engineering for the band, and one guy does the engineering for the choirs, and one guy does the engineering for the orchestra.
I mean, sure, I understand all of that, but I don't know. The other thing as well to note is that where this actually got on the charts. Now,
not
in the
very
US,
well, I imagine.
So, the US top hard rock albums, where do you reckon?
Right, we're number one because I'm reading the same Wikipedia article you are.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway.
So, number one.
It US made number Billboard, 11 at Billboard.
Exactly. Billboard was number 11. UK albums was number 11. ARIA charts, it got to number 10.
Yeah, but we've discussed before about how the charts work in this context.
I know. I am aware
of it doesn't
of
take
that.
Much to get. You know, if you've got a particularly hardcore fan base, it does not take much to get a top 10 record these days.
Oh, I know, but it's still interesting that it did sort of reasonably well. Now, that being said, I think from memory the next week it was like 85 or something.
That was going to be my next point. It's like, okie dokie, it may have come in at number whatever, but how far did it drop?
Yes.
I know this was the problem with Brilliant Sphere album. It went in at number 4 in 1 week and then completely bombed out of the charts the following week.
Yeah, I know.
Because they use pre-sales now as well to determine chart positions, which is why they did their pre-order campaign with Pledge Music.
Yeah.
And despite their chart eligibility of Pledge Music, they will not be doing their next album with Pledge Music because Pledge Music completely cocked it up.
That's right. So, I don't know. Overall, isn't an album that you want to listen to if you're new to Dream Theater. So my girlfriend is not a massive Dream Theater fan, but as I mentioned, we're flying to the States in April to see them, to see them in New York at the Beacon Theater there, which will be amazing. So she actually said to me the other day, hey, what are the songs that I should listen to? What's the crash course, right, of Dream Theater? This is going to be right at the bottom of the list.
Yep, absolutely.
If I'm really honest.
Yep.
Now, this is the really hard thing for me because I don't think it's a bad album, right? I genuinely don't think this is a bad album, but it's a bad Dream Theater album.
Yeah.
Akin to if you go back to Linkin Park, which was basically a gateway for all of us, let's be honest.
True.
To heavy music, you know, Hybrid Theory, to an extent Reanimation, Meteora, brilliant albums. Then they brought out that next piece of shit and everyone went, not a Linkin Park album.
Which
What's
one,
going
which,
on?
Which one are you talking about? Minutes to Midnight.
Midnight, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the one that came after that, which I think was A Thousand Suns.
Yes.
And then
the one that everybody hated.
Yeah, and then they slowly got more poppy and poppy and poppy and poppy and poppy. Until obviously the end there with Chester. It's just.
But this is the problem, though. Can you really expect musicians who are singing that sort of style of music to continue in that same vein? I had a friend of mine who said to me, it's going to be very hard in the next Tool record because when you're a millionaire, he's got his own vineyard, you can't exactly be singing about the same stuff that you did on all the records that everybody likes.
I don't know about that because realistically, I mean, Tool, and this is a different sort of thing, but Tool never really sang about hardships. I mean, they weren't, they're not gangster rappers talking about how much of a problem it is growing up in the hood. You know, I mean, they were talking about, I mean, essentially they went on DMT trips and wrote what they saw. So, I mean, allegedly. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you look at songs like Lateralis and, you know, Vicarious and all that. I don't actually see those songs as being songs of rebellion or anything like that. I see them more as songs of intellectualism.
Hmm.
So I don't know. That's just me. But
yeah. But you are right. Going back to the original question, is this an album for new Dream Theater fans? No. Is this an album for the deep hardcore Dream Theater fans? Probably not.
Yeah.
I think people expecting a sort of a normal, if there is such a thing, normal Dream Theater record are not going to get that with this album.
Yeah.
They were going for a concept. Did the concept ultimately work? No. Unfortunately not. Very ambitious. I don't think. Is there any way that this album could have been any better?
Yes.
How? Do tell.
Cut the track list.
But are you able to do that, though, and still come up with a coherent song? Kiss tried. I mean, okay, this is completely the other end of the musical spectrum because we're talking about a band that are not musicians, they're entertainers. Kiss did that with What was the album called? Music from the Elder. That's right. Mm-hmm. It was written again as the soundtrack to an album, the soundtrack to a movie that hadn't been made. And then the record company got involved, altered the track list to try and create or try and draw emphasis to certain singles, which made the whole problem even worse. And you ended up with a muddled, horrible piece of junk.
Yeah.
Which you could say about a lot of Kiss albums, I know. But we'll put that to one side for the purposes of my argument.
I think one of the big problems with this album as well, and this is probably going to be the last time I say one of the big problems with this album, is if you look at the track times, right, there's 34 tracks. The average length of every song is probably about 5 minutes.
Yep.
So it really felt like if you look at The Gift of Music, right, it ended weird. I remember it ending, felt like it ended prematurely, like they wanted it to go further. You know what I mean? And I think this is one of the problems when you are used to writing longer form songs, and I'm talking from experience now, most of the stuff that I write is around about the 8 to 11 minutes mark. Somewhere around there, right? So proggy kind of weird stuff. When you try and write something that's 3 minutes, it's really fucking hard.
Oh, absolutely. Right? I mean,
if you're writing something four or five, it's even worse because you come up with this little cool little riff somewhere and then you're like, fuck, I want that to go here and here and here, and you can't. You go, son of a bitch. You know, and I think that's one of the big problems here is that there's all these songs that really feel like they want to take off.
But they can't because they've got to keep the story moving forward.
That's right. You know, and I genuinely think they wrote the story first, and maybe they did, wrote the story first and then sort of wrote the music to suit that.
I think that's pretty much how it went.
Which is, in my opinion, not the way that Dream Theater have traditionally done things.
Yeah, they've always written the music first.
Yeah.
I think the way that it's sort of been music, then the melody, then the lyrics.
Yeah.
Which has always been I know some people sort of criticize the band in that way, particularly drummers, because the drums kind of have to stay out of the way of everything because they've got a whole song written and then the lyrics come in. Whereas if you take a Rush song, for example, Neil Peart's the one writing the lyrics. So he says that he's able to frame his drum parts to fit the lyrical phrasing and sort of, you know, sometimes, yeah, you just got to lay out of the way and let the lyrics stand out the front. But then you can bring the drums in to sort of accentuate or sort of add punctuation to certain things. You can't do that when you've got the whole song written and, now we're going to do the lyrics.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think that the album itself had potential, had a lot of potential there, but they missed the mark. They really did.
Yep.
And coming from probably the two biggest Dream Theater fans in Australia and New Zealand, I don't like saying things like that because I do love the band and I love the stuff that they put out and I know what it's like being Muso and then someone coming up and being like, so that's shit.
Yeah.
But it is what it is, you know?
I think, even though the band, or certain members of the band anyway, are saying the album is polarizing. This is always the thing with being a musician. I'm not a musician. I can only speak to what I've heard other musicians say, is that there's always a difference between what ends up on the record versus what was in your mind when you were writing it.
Yep.
There's always going to be a difference or some sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, disconnect or whatever.
Yep.
There's always a difference. And how close you get to the sound in your head will determine on how much you actually like a record. Like you personally as a musician I'm talking about.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that is true. But there's obviously a lot of other stuff that comes into it as well, mixing and mastering and all that sort of stuff. So it is certainly part of it. So I suppose, look, overall, for me, it's not a thumbs up. It's not a thumbs down. It's kind of a, you know, hand out and wiggle it from side to side.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's the best way to say this album.
Maybe the way out of it was to kind of take a Coheed and Cambria type approach. You see what they've got, this huge, grand, kind of big overarching storyline that they're trying to tell. But rather than trying to tell it in one album, they're doing it in a series of about half a dozen.
That's right, yeah.
Could this potentially have been something that you could do like that? Sort of
over
a couple of different albums?
Look, I think this whole story would have really worked as sort of like the next AA suite, in inverted commas.
Oh, okay, you sort of have portions of it on different albums.
Yeah, I really think that would have worked.
Or instead of putting it out as one album, you put it out as like a series of EPs or something.
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, on the off years. So you're right, these guys roughly have an album coming out every 2 years. So in the first year, you release a bit of the EP and then do a full album and then repeat the EP and then a full album and then release the EP and a full album, that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have worked. I don't know. But
This is something as well that I think Dream Theater have been – they don't seem to want to do albums in a different way. They're very much locked into this write, record, tour sort of thing. Other band – maybe – I know this is what you were talking about earlier, where they sort of almost of a different era in a way where they don't necessarily do pre-orders. They don't necessarily have – that closer connection with the fan base in terms of stuff from the studio and that like other bands do. I totally understand that's not for everybody and you don't necessarily want half bits of things being prognosticated over on the internet all day long. Maybe I don't know how they could work that in or have a sort of move with that and do it in a different way. Maybe that would help, but they seem pretty happy doing this sort of way, the way that they've always done it, if you know what I mean.
So, yeah, so that's that. That's The Astonishing. And our next album review, full-scale album review that I suppose we're going to bring to you, will probably be Velocity or Distance Over Time.
Probably.
as we are sort of calling it now. So, look, I think we need to pretty well wrap it up from there.
Yep. Ordinarily as well, we normally go into our album reviews, but we're going to play slightly logy here. Neither of us have had the time this week to listen to them.
Yep, exactly.
You haven't listened to the one I recommended you. I haven't listened to the one that you recommended to me.
Nope.
So we're going to push that off to the next episode.
Correct. And next fortnight, we are also going to be implementing a new little mini segment called Bandwatch. So if you have a particular band that you know that you would like us to have a listen to and see whether or not we would recommend it to the masses, by all means, please flick that through to us. But we are going to be recommending one each to you, the listeners, to go out and check so that you can support the local scene as we sort of keep going with this 9/8 podcast thing and hope that it sort of reaches more people and that we can become a little bit more of a staple in the scene around. So until next time, my name is David Ellis.
And my name is Alex Hogg. We'll see you all next time.
Catch you then.
See ya.